Every year since 1978, there's been a citywide search in New York for the highest achieving students of color. And these kids go on to take accelerated classes and enroll in the city's most elite private schools as part of a program called Prep for Prep. There are similar programs in cities and towns throughout the country. And our next guest wonders if these programs, while offering opportunities to some, obscure deeper educational inequalities. Vincent Cunningham is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He recently wrote about this, as well as his own experience in the Prep for Prep program. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So, Vincent, you start off your essay by taking us back to Brown versus Board of Education and the tried experiments in New York City to desegregate public schools. And I was struck by the use of the word experiment in the form of Prep for Prep, or really any gifted or talented accelerated program. Can you explain your thoughts on this?
Sure. And it's not just gifted and talented education. Educating children of color has been an experiment sort of from the beginning in our country. You know, I didn't put this in the piece, but my mom was bused to schools, for example, another experiment that happened in the late 60s and 70s. So there's always been this issue of working around essentially racial backlash of against school education. After Brown versus Board, schools, in fact, got more segregated based on the backlash of individual and collective white parents and school boards really around the country, and especially in New York City. So there has been this sort of jerry-rigging that has had to happen in order to get children educated.
You've been wanting to write this story about your experience in being part of Prep for Prep for a really long time. Why?
Well, it's something that has made me who I am, and I think Prep for Prep certainly opened up all kinds of new vistas for me, new education opportunities that I didn't know existed when I was younger. As I mentioned in the piece, my wife is a alum of the program. Many of my best friends are. So it's something that I've always thought in the back of my mind might be something to write about.
Yes, you definitely write in a complex and nuanced way your experience from being in the program and then post-program. You write, quote, "Much of what I have that is good, I can trace back to the program. The change isn't only personal. No matter the context, certain privileges accompany being thought smart. Teachers kindle your ego. People listen when you talk." Can you explain more about that?
I think this applies to everything. This isn't just Black children or Latino children. This is everybody. Whenever you enter a new context, there's this strange doubling that happens. On your end, you're seeing something new. You've expanded your view on existence has opened up, even if it's just a crack. But at the same time, you become a new element in that place. So you start to be seen in different ways. And often you don't notice that until much later, that, you know, your presence, for example, if you're a Black kid in a largely white school, like I was in high school, that you mean something to those people around you in a way that, you know, you might not even notice.
You write, "Alongside my friends, from a jarring double vantage of privilege and its lack, I came to know America better and began honing my responses to it."
It's interesting. Whenever you're in a place that's not necessarily consonant with where you're from, you feel that tension. There's a sort of rub of one experience against the other. You know, most of my friends in high school, we weren't from wealthy families. Our families were mostly, you know, working class, but we were at the school with people who certainly were not that, you know. In the piece I write about a friend of mine, an older kid, was the person that I was with when we found out that the police officers who had killed Amadou Diallo in high school in New York City, had shot him.
Mistaking
him as a rapist, absolutely. And I sort of weathered that first moment of shock of those acquittals with another kid who had been through a lot of the same things as I was and was kind of living in these two worlds. And so there is that kind of camaraderie that comes out of those experiences as well.
Journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, as you write, has pointed out that these types of programs, while they benefit kids like you, they also obscure the system's deep inequalities because they allow us to say, quote, and this is her quote, "If kids really wanted an education, if they wanted to work hard, they could get it. Look at this program." So it really just allows us to sustain all of these other inequalities or feel okay about it. Your essay really brings up this real question. Is a program like Prep for Prep, not only in New York, but really throughout the country, there are programs like this. In 2020, is this the way to lessen the educational disparity in public schools that we see right now?
Right. And what I hope the piece does bring out is that this is something that has been this question, right, of taking out so-called, you know, talented, I guess I'd put that in square quotes, children, and taking them out of their contexts and using that as a way to change the face of a leadership class versus a more sort of idea of common schooling that's supposed to maybe sand down the inequalities among people. That sort of tension has been alive in America since the beginning. Thomas Jefferson, before he became governor of Virginia, he wrote some legislation that would establish these schools whereby they would sort of go around the country taking up the sort of brightest young white man always who kind of couldn't pay for school but scored the highest of these varying measures. So this is a kind of model and an idea that's been operative in American life and culture for a long time. The question of what we ought to do now, I think it's just, if anything, this is intensifying. There's always been the urge, especially of, I can say from my experience, Black parents, that, hey, this system isn't working for us. And so there is an idea of self-determination that says, okay, by sort of any means necessary, whether it's vacating that system, whether it's trying to decentralize the public schools, and by one hook or crook or another, something else has to happen, because we've been in this sort of holding pattern with school segregation for half of the 20th century and another 20 years in the 21st. It does seem that something on one end or the other does have to give.
You have a quote from someone referring to W.E.B. Du Bois's notion that all races are going to be saved by exceptional men. And your source says through these programs, they help, but they don't help the collectives. That's kind of what you're talking about. Basically, our success alone does not open any doors. Do you think that we should be reassessing these programs at this time? Or do you think that we should be thinking about it more holistically, that these programs continue to stay, but we're really basically tacking on other experiments as a way to lessen this systemic segregation that we continue to see in our public school systems?
I don't know which end it has to start on. It seems to me that things have to start from the ground up. I think just like what happened in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, that this has to be led by parents who have the greatest stake in their children.
And to give people an understanding of what happened there, as you said, parents came together and decided on their own, like they were going to take control of the school systems there.
Absolutely. And they were certainly, it was a broad swath of the sort of city establishment that came together to undertake these decentralized school districts. But it was crucially on the parents that were in support of it. And that was the only way that it ever could have worked. But when you talk about reassessing these programs like this, I think it's, you know, to be fair to Du Bois, toward the end of his life, he also softened on that notion of a talented 10th and said, okay, yeah, there will be people that will be better educated because of whatever talents or opportunities or privileges that they have. But their leadership can't only be a function of their success. You know, that these people also have to be moral leaders and crucially go back and fight for the common good of all people. So while he held on to that notion, you did see a substantive change in that, you know, that idea that, as you say, their success alone would in some way herald a better future for their people.
What's been the response from people to your essay?
I've heard a lot from people that were in the program, both when I was there and before and after. And I think hopefully the upshot of what I've seen is that there are a lot of people who have been asking these questions themselves. And I usually, you know, when you write an essay like this, that's kind of poking around and going through the years and asking questions. You don't necessarily want to get up, you know, behind a podium. All you really want is to start a conversation. And to the extent that it seems to have done that, I'm very happy.
Yes. Well, it definitely has done that. Vincent Cunningham is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and we'll link his article about the Prep for Prep program at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, Vincent, for joining us.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much.